carries in, scores! Patrick Laine snaps it. What a goal by Laine.
Gotta throw this one in the trash and move on. That's not obviously the way you want to start.
Shooting, it's off of Hellebuck. Rebound, it's out of the net. Stopped by Hellebuck. Key saves for Connor Hellebuck.
Johnson scores. Sidney Crosby.
As long as we stick together as a team, we'll be all right.
Stand by highlight. Stand by host. You big boy.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Miles, everyone.
With Drew Mendel, Ezra Ginsberg, and Dave Manute.
And cue the little criminal.
On your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Anderson picks it up again. Rolls off the wall. High slot. Shoots and scores. Josh Anderson ends it with a goal for the slot and a wrist shot. And for the second night in a row, Winnipeg falls in defeat in overtime. Final score, Columbus 2, Winnipeg 1.
Paulie Edmonds with the call last night. The Blue Jackets defeat the Winnipeg Jets 2-1 in overtime. Second consecutive overtime defeat for the Winnipeg Jets. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live on the iHeartRadio app and TSN1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. I'm your host, Drew Mendel, joined in studio by Dave Manuke and Ezra Ginsberg. You can reach us in studio via Twitter. At Illegal Curve is the way to do that. Send us your tweets. If they're decent enough to be read on air, I may go ahead and do so. Send us your texts to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply, but the same rules apply. If they're good enough to be read on air, I may go ahead and do so. And our website, that's got the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio and Manitoba Moose news and audio. That's illegalcurve.com. Without further ado, I say good morning to David. I say good morning to Ezra. Gentlemen, good to see you both on this Saturday morning.
What's up, Drew? That's a scary costume you're wearing right now.
That's very clever. That's funny. That's ha, 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 ha. You be able to think of that one all on your own?
Yep.
Okay, well, I'm not actually wearing a costume. That, I think, is the joke, is what Ezzy was trying to make.
Actually, Dave helped me out with that one.
Oh, you guys, that was a joint effort, yeah. Was it there, Dave?
I can't come up with that stuff on my own, Drew. Come on.
That's fair enough. Dave is the brains of the operation, as we all well know.
Just make sure you have some good candy to give out on Tuesday, Drew.
Laura has already bought some chocolates. The neighborhood kids, I'm sure, will be coming to the door and ringing the doorbell and will be pleased with the selection that we hand out to them. I have no idea. Anyways, gentlemen, last night, of course, the Jets fall 2-1 at the hands of the Columbus Blue Jackets. Second game in back-to-back situations.
It was a bit of a snoozer at times.
Yeah, it wasn't the most exciting game I've ever watched, but I think that's probably by design that the Jets wanted it that way. They sort of played a road game on the second half of a back-to-back in the manner in which most teams probably will in the NHL, which is try to keep things very calm, very uneventful.
Yeah, simple. And, you know, it was an exciting finish with Cam Atkinson scoring the late goal and the game going into overtime. Obviously, Blake Wheeler almost wins it. Sergei Bobrovsky makes that unbelievable save. Then on the winning goal, Steve Mason loses his stick, and he's kind of like looking for it, even though it's really close to him, and he doesn't want to lose focus of what's going on in front of him. But the Jets really, as a whole, I think, played pretty well in these two games. And don't get me wrong, there were times in that game that Columbus completely dominated the zone time, the possession, the pace of play, especially in the second period. I thought that was the period where the Jets were really lucky to escape that without allowing a goal. And even kind of the last 5 to 7 minutes of the first period. Because if you remember, the first 5 to 8 minutes of that first period, the Jets were all over Columbus. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed with the way they were playing coming off, you know, the game in Pittsburgh, as you mentioned, Drew, second game of a back-to-back. So, I mean, the Jets overall, I think there's a lot to be happy about. You pick up 2 points of a possible 4 points. But you were going up against two really good teams, two elite teams in the Eastern Conference. But when you consider that the Columbus Blue Jackets came into Bell MTS Place and embarrassed the Jets, scored 5 goals, I think this was a pretty good response for the Jets with everything considered, with the injuries and all of that. Are there things that need to be improved for the Jets? Absolutely. I mean, the Jets, I still think at times are turning the puck over too much, especially in their own zone. And, you know, the speed of the game, I think, is really shown against teams like Columbus and Pittsburgh. But you got 2 points. You could have easily won either of these games, right?
Well, that's what I was going to sort of mention there, Dave. I'll bring you in on this one. You get 2 out of the 4 points. So if you had said before the road trip started that you're going to win one of these two games in Pittsburgh or Columbus, most fans would probably say, okay, I can accept that. Two upper echelon NHL teams, you're going to win one of the two. I mean, the Jets obviously didn't, but they get the 2 points by sending both games into overtime, something that they failed to do time and time again last season. They never got those sort of quote-unquote extra points or the loser point, whatever you want to call it. But if you're the Jets, especially last night, you have this 1-0 lead early in the game, 4 minutes and 52 seconds into the first period. Brandon Tanev gets the first 5-on-5 goal from the Jets' bottom six this season. And you got the 1-0 lead, and you have to be saying to yourself, if the power play just could do anything at all, I mean, the Blue Jackets take those 3 first-period penalties, and the Jets have a golden opportunity to get a multiple-goal lead, and they just can't do anything on the power play whatsoever. And we'll talk about the power play later on in the show today. But you have to just be saying that there's a bit of a lost opportunity there. Sure, you get the 1 point, and you get the 1 point in Pittsburgh. But, it was prime pickings to get 2 points last night in Columbus.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And Ezzie's right. Had Blake Wheeler put that puck in the net in the overtime. I mean, you're talking about a road trip where the Jets come out with 3 or 4 points. There's no question the power play needs to be better. Probably also to be remembered, though, is that, as we've touched on already, Columbus is a very good team. They also have a top 5 power play. I think they're 5th best in the NHL right now, around 90% kill. So, I mean, it's not exactly – I mean, there's 2 teams that play. You can't just say, well, we have effective players. And don't get me wrong, I think the Jets' power play needs to be better and should be better. But the fact is that it's not exactly up against the 30th ranked power play. A penalty kill in
5th,
the league. So
88% Columbus's
penalty
kill.
That's what I said. So, yeah. I mean, like, to me, Columbus is a very good team, and we touched on it. The fact is, and Ezzie and I talked about this earlier when we're coming to the station, these are games that you don't remember in the midseason, but, when it comes time to pushing for a playoff spot and you actually have a couple of extra points in the bank that you may not have had last year, then it's probably a good thing. And so, sure, of course you want... nobody says, well, we're happy getting 2 of 4, because the reality is you want 3 or 4 of 4. That's the whole point of playing, is that you want to win. You don't want to come out with 50%. But the fact is that, they maintain the Pittsburgh game. They managed to get a point out of that game, even though Pittsburgh was fantastic, I thought. And the truth is, in Columbus, they just played a good first period, but, as anticipated, the second period was a lot of Columbus, simply because the Jets are probably a little bit tired at that point. Columbus is pushing back. And again, do you think that the power play, had it been configured differently, had it done more? Of course, it changes the game. So it's something that the team needs to work on. There's no doubt about that. But, it's just unfortunate, because, again, you're happy to have salvaged 2 of 4. But, you could also, again, conversely, to my point, you could have look back and say, well, here's an opportunity that we left, a couple of points that we could have taken on, and banked later on in the season.
And Dave, what's unfortunate is that the first two penalties that the Blue Jackets took were both the result of the Jet speed, right? Mm-hmm. Nikolaj Ehlers is tripped by Marcus Nutavera, and then Brandon Tanev was hooked by Zach Werenski, and the Jets just couldn't find any of that speed on the power play. I thought their zone entries were bad. I thought that they just were a little bit rushed. They just couldn't seem to control the puck in the Blue Jackets zone, which is something that we've seen, I think, more so at home from the Jets. The Jets have been able to set up, and, whether it's getting Mark Scheifele the puck in the middle of the slot, setting up Patrick Laine on the left side there. I just didn't think that they had any setup and any intensity, any urgency to their power play. You saw Kyle Connor was out there on the power play, and he got rid of the puck really quickly. I just thought that they were very rushed, and they weren't able to set up. And I think they only had two or three shots on those first two power plays, if I'm not mistaken. And when you consider that that was a good opportunity to go up by 2 goals or go up by 3 goals, I think it really set the Jets back. And Dave is right. I mean, the Jets' power play, I think you could say that it has improved at times this year, but at times it's looked very similar to last year's power play, right? But in this game specifically, especially early on in the first period, as we mentioned, you know, the first kind of 8 to 10 minutes of this game, the Jets looked like the faster team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this power play or these power plays did is it actually slowed the game down. It slowed the Jets down. And it was actually doing the opposite effect. These power plays didn't help them. They actually hurt them.
It's an interesting perspective in that you think that they sort of lost some of the speed they were playing with because they had the man advantage and they were trying to set up in the zone and everything.
Well, and they couldn't get set up. Watch that game, I mean, the Jets were having trouble setting up their power play and they didn't get a lot of shots on net. I mean, again, I don't have the stats in front of me here, but when you look at how many shots that the Jets did have on those three power plays, it couldn't have been more than three shots.
No, they were horrendous on the power play. I mean, the one that jumps out to me the most in the game is the one in the third period where David Savard is in the box for taking the roughing penalty. By the way, sort of as an aside, how did Brendan Lemieux not get penalized for that hit from behind?
Yeah, well, I mean, Jack Johnson does turn into the boards. So
the ref is standing right there. That's a textbook hit from behind. I mean, I know that, you know, some people watch the games with their fan glasses on, but that's called 99 times out of 100.
Sure, it could have been a penalty.
Yeah. But Drew, see, that's the point. That was the 100th time. So well, the ref had to put the whistle away.
Okay, whatever it was, it was a bizarre no call. And then
couldn't have Boone Jenner got a kneeing penalty on Shifley?
Absolutely. He absolutely could have, but I mean, you know, and I'm not excusing one to say that, you know, it's a makeup for the other one, but whatever it might be, I thought the fact that the Jets ended up with a power play in that sequence,
right,
where Brendan Lemieux hits Johnson from behind and then David Savard roughs Lemieux to get, you know, for retaliation. Anyways, on that power play, the one that stands out to me is the puck is in the corner and there's a puck battle there and there's three Blue Jackets players and two Jets players and the Jets are the team that's on the power play. Why aren't you supporting the puck better? Why aren't you going in there to win that puck battle? You win that puck battle, you have your opposition completely out of position. Instead, the Blue Jackets win the puck battle like they did on every power play last night for the most part. And the power play goes for naught.
And, you know, the Jets just weren't sharp, Drew. And you can't blame the fact that it's the second game of a back-to-back. They just weren't sharp. We talked about it. You know, there needs to be more urgency. As you said, you have to win more of those one-on-one puck battles. And you have to have more concentrated zone time, right? I mean, the Jets really weren't able to set up their power play at all like they wanted to. How many power plays did they have last night?
Six.
Five, six?
Six.
Right? So, I mean, they just weren't a big threat to the Blue Jackets at all last night, right? So when you're talking about, you know, the special teams and the penalty kill was fine last night, but it was really the power play that let them down.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, they were horrendous on the power play last night. I mean, I can't even speak to how bad they were. And that really, to me, is the difference in the game. If they're able to get the power play, not even you know, 50% of the time. If you're able to get 25% of the power plays there and resulting in a goal, you probably win the game last night. So that's why I think there's so much, you know, consternation in the fan base. I mean, this fan base is still so tremendously on edge. And that even getting...
Yeah, but you know what, Drew? They're always going to be on edge. I mean, this is Winnipeg here.
Yeah,
the fans are always going to be on edge.
No, I think it's more right now than it used to be. I think, you know, the fact... If this had been last year or 2 years ago and you go to Pittsburgh and Columbus and you get a point in each game, I think people are a lot more calm about it. Now everything is apoplectic in from what I'm seeing. Everything the Jets do.
Right, and it depends if you're looking at this from a glass-half-full perspective or a glass-half-empty perspective. The Jets have got 6 points in 6 of their last 7 games, but they've also lost 3 of their last 4, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, how do you want to look at it, right? I mean, the Jets right now, I believe, are in 8th in the Western Conference. So when you look at how some of the other teams are doing, Edmonton Oilers, a lot of people were picking them to go to the Stanley Cup Final, myself included. You're talking about the Chicago Blackhawks, the Minnesota Wild. I mean, these teams aren't separating themselves. When you're talking about the Western Conference, the only teams that are really separating themselves are the St. Louis Blues, the LA Kings, and the Golden Knights.
Well, we'll talk about the Golden Knights later on in the show because what they continue to do is absolutely amazing. Quickly, guys, some thoughts on Steve Mason's performance last night.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we haven't even really talked about Steve Mason, guys. I mean, 35 saves, and a lot of those were of the spectacular variety. I mean, this was easily his best game of the year mm-hmm. in a building that he was very familiar with, right? He played many years in Nationwide Arena. So, I mean, give Steve Mason a lot of credit here because he was coming into a situation having not played the previous game and the previous game that he was in was not his best performance either against the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Right.
So I think you got to give him all the respect in the world for what he was able to do in Columbus. He was very sharp all night. And, you know, it wasn't just the saves that he made, you know, when the Jets were killing penalties, or the saves that he made later in the game. It was his overall performance. I thought he just looked really confident in net. And I think that bodes very well, because we know how well Hellebuck is playing. And when you have two goalies playing, that's always better than only having, you know, one goaltender that you know is going to give you an elite level of goaltending. So, I mean, what can you say? I mean, for me, he was the first star of the game for the Jets.
Steve Mason needed that game desperately, Dave.
Yeah, no, I thought so. I thought the Atkinson goal against was a bit of an unusual one. And it looked like it. I mean, Ehlers didn't have Atkinson, and then it just kind of handcuffed Mason a little bit with just kind of bounced it in. It was probably a goal he wants back, but I concur with what Ez said. I thought he had his, you know, best game of the season in a game he needed to play his best.
He almost had a shutout.
No, I'm saying, like, I thought he was phenomenal. I thought he was really good. And the truth is, as you just said, touched on, Ezzy, that was a game he absolutely needed to have for his confidence. I mean, the reality is, he's an NHL veteran, and one game isn't going to make or break him, but he's consistently had a few games where he's let in 5 goals. So to be able to have a game where it's only a two goals against, and again, it was, you know, an overtime goal, I thought it was the game he needed to have. I mean, again, Connor Hellebuck's the hot hand, and you're going to likely see him being ridden for a while, but again, it allows the coaching staff to have confidence again in Steve Mason, and to give Steve Mason that confidence in himself that he's going to need to moving forward.
When we come back, we talk about the Jets' pace of play. Is Paul Maurice throttling down on this team too much? Is he holding them back? When we come back, that's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning on TSN 1290, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and this segment of the program is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. For more information and to make your teeth ting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. On Wednesday's NHL This Week show, we were joined by Sean Tierney. Sean is on Twitter at HockeyCharts, or pardon me, at Charting Hockey. And he also covers the game for HockeyGraphs and for TheAthletic.com. He had some interesting information regarding the Winnipeg Jets and their pace of play and their style of play through the first, you know, 10 or so games this year. Here's what Sean had to say on Wednesday's NHL This Week.
For the Jets this year, again, it's a very strange story. We know we're looking at a team that's got huge offensive talent sort of throughout the lineup. But for whatever reason, Coach Maurice seems to have the team playing this very passive or defensive style. So the Jets, in terms of their own shot generation, they're about even with the Minnesota Wild. And then only the Canucks and the Sabres are generating less shot attempts per 60 minutes. So they're right at the very bottom of the league. For a team that has as much skill as they have, you really want to be pushing the pace and getting a lot of pucks on goal. And, you know, they're right at the bottom of the league right now. So it's not a recipe for success in general, and especially for a team that has the kind of offensive guns that the Jets do. In terms of the shots that they're allowing against, they're about league average right now, a little bit over league average. You know, that's an okay place to be if you're generating your own shots going the other way. But the Jets right now are just, they're generating almost nothing at all, and it's a real waste of the talent that they have.
Sean, how does this compare with, say, last year's Winnipeg Jets? The forward group is very similar. I mean, Kyle Connor has been up now and playing maybe a bigger role than he did last season. So how do these, you know, expected goal rates and the team shot rates for the Jets compare to last year's Winnipeg Jets?
It's worse. It's definitely worse, which is part of the reason why going into the off season and some of the work that was done in the summer, there were some really strong projections for the Jets suggesting that, you know, looking at the lineup that they had and the kind of shot rates and expected goals that the players, you know, were generating last year, and like you said, returning in a lot of ways a very similar lineup, the projections were strong if you sort of went across from model to model looking at what we could expect from the Jets this year. But the real difference, and it's a little bit difficult to explain why the coaching staff has thought that slowing this team back in the way that they've slowed them down was the way they wanted to go forward. But, you know, the results are very mixed so far. And, you know, if the Jets really want to capitalize this season going forward, they're really going to have to dial up the pace and look to generate more chances and get back to doing a little bit more what they did last year.
Sean Tierney is our guest on NHL This Week.
So that was Sean Tierney from NHL This Week on Wednesday night talking about the Jets, you know, pace of play more than anything, and how they've been a much more defensive team, which, I mean, defense is good. Nobody's saying that defense is bad, but that they're really towards the bottom of the league in all the... I mean, you got to score goals to win the game.
Yep.
And what Sean is saying is that the Jets, while they might be scoring some goals now, the way their numbers are lying and the way their numbers are trending, it's not going to last.
Well, these last two games, I think, guys, are a really good indicator of kind of the differences in style that the Jets are playing this year, right? Because when you're talking about the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Columbus Blue Jackets, I mean, these are two of the fastest teams in the league, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pittsburgh, I would say, maybe gets a bit of an edge, but Columbus is a fast team when you talk about guys like Artemi Panarin and Cam Atkinson and Alex Wenberg, Seth Jones, Zach Werenski. I mean, that Columbus Blue Jackets back end, guys, I think is a top five back end in the NHL. And Ryan Murray's a guy that doesn't get talked about a lot. He's a great third pairing guy.
Columbus second in the NHL in Corsi's so far
right.
this season.
No, Columbus. 55. I mean, you know, I pick Columbus to go to the Stanley Cup final this year. They're an elite team, Drew, and I think we saw last year, I mean, just was a taste of what's to come. Because when you consider that the Columbus Blue Jackets are still a very young team, right? I mean, this isn't a team that is stocked with veterans. Sure, you've got some veterans there when you're talking about guys like Brandon Dubinsky and Jack Johnson. But
let me ask you this, Ed.
Sure.
Can the Jets play at top speed? Can they play at top speed and be successful? Because it seems that Paul Maurice, as the coach of the Jets,
right.
thinks that they can't.
Well, in today's NHL, guys, you have to. Right? And that's the name of the game. I mean, we know that the NHL over the last, I would say, 3 or 4 years especially, has moved to a speed game. And I mean, obviously, you know, we're talking in generalities here. I mean, you can't really simplify it to can they play at top speed or not. I mean, hockey's always been a fast game, but it's even more so, I would say, over the last 3 or 4 years. And you're starting to see a movement away from those bigger stay-at-home defensemen. Now, we know that with some of the teams that haven't had success in the NHL, you have to have a mobile back end. And the Jets do have a mobile back end. But when you're talking about just the speed of the game, especially depending on what type of game it's going to be. For example, when Carolina came in last weekend and the Jets played them, that wasn't a very fast team. I mean, they're kind of more of a slower team.
Two Saturdays ago,
I should say. And Carolina is a team that is very good defensively, but they struggle to produce offensively. They're not a top-end offensive team like the Blue Jackets or the Penguins are. I'm not saying that the Hurricanes aren't a good team. I'm just saying they're a step below the elite teams of the East. So the Jets always have to play at top speed, because when you're playing at top speed, Drew, not only are you generating shots and scoring chances, you're forcing the other team to play in their own zone. And that's why the old saying is the best defense is a good offense.
The only thing I would interject is that clearly from what this team is saying, the point is that this year is not going to be like last year. I mean, like Blake Wheeler talks about it. Coach Maurice has talked about it. So you can want the team to play a certain way with the horses that they have. But to answer your original question, Drew, I think that he is doing that, but it's intentional. It's not like he's doing this. Like if the question is he doing this, but it's unintentional? The answer is no. Is he doing it, but it's intentional? The answer is yes, because the point is that he felt that the team, again, this is not my rationale. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not justifying it. I'm simply saying this is what
the explanation is.
The explanation.
The logic.
If you listen to what he says, Coach Maurice, that is, he constantly talks about the fact that they have to play defensive hockey. They have to play better defensively. And we saw that last year. How many times did they get into horse races where they put up a bunch of goals, but they ended up losing the games? So the fact is, his focus is making this a better defensive team. And he's, again, whether you agree or disagree with it, the fact of the matter is that's his rationale, is through that defense will come offensive opportunities. So, you know, if Nikolaj Ehlers backchecks in a certain manner, or, you know, has a stick in a lane or has this or he does that. The reality is then his focus is that they'll be able to transition, get that puck up ice, and create a chance from it. So all I'm saying is that's his focus. And if you listen to Blake Wheeler, for example, we went into the room after one of the games and they said, I think it was a 2-1 win against Carolina. And he said, someone asked him about it and he goes, well, that's what we have to do. That's the way we're going to win. So it's not a function of we've got these horses like Patrick Laine, Nikolai Ehlers, Blake Wheeler, Mark Scheifele, and we're going to score a ton of goals and we're going to be in the shootouts every game. He said the fans are going to have to sit on their hands because there's going to be some nervous times while Jets try and play a little more disciplined brand of hockey.
So they can't play – so it seems like the answer is, or the result is, they cannot be a defensively sound team and offensively inclined at the same time.
Well, I don't think that the two have to be separate, really. I think you ideally want to have a team that uses its speed and creates a lot of scoring chances, but also plays well defensively.
Right? But it doesn't seem like that Paul Maurice feels that this team has the ability to do that.
Well, I'll tell you this much, and you know, you hear a lot about pressure and speed when you're watching the broadcasts, and we've seen certain games where the Jets, for me, it's an aggressive forecheck. That's what I've seen from the Jets in certain games. I think you saw it against Pittsburgh. You saw it against Edmonton. You definitely did not see it last night. And, you know, part of that is it's a second game of a back-to-back. But when you're talking about, you know, this different style that the Jets have played, you know, we've seen kind of that left-wing lock, you know, dropping back into a little bit more of a, you know, a defensive set, right? A little bit more of a defensive system at times.
Yeah.
And at times, the Jets have looked slow. And when you consider that the Jets have players like Nikolai Ehlers and Jacob Trouba and a lot Brandon Tanev, I mean, they've got fast players. Matthew Perreault, Brian Little, Blake Wheeler. I mean, the Jets have no shortage. This is the most talented roster the Jets have ever put on the ice, in my opinion. And what the unfortunate part is that the Jets are not generating enough shots with this talented group of players that they have.
But that seems as though it's a deliberate course of action and a deliberate strategy by the coaching staff.
Yeah, but you might be stifling offense in the system.
I think you are. I mean, you know, and now the Jets are the third worst team in Corsi in the entire NHL.
Right, and that's a problem.
So at some point in time, sure, the results right now are okay. I mean, if you had said, you know,
sure, they're a 500 team.
Yeah, they're 4-3-2 right now. They're in a playoff spot. They're okay.
Right.
But can it be sustained? Can that stand throughout the course of the next 72 games this season?
I think it becomes a function of, is this being done on purpose? Is this being done? Is this by design? So the fact is, you know, you've just illustrated it, Drew. They do have all these offensive weapons. If they have them playing defense the way they want them to do, which is, again, you know, under a better structure, if they can get that focus and have the goaltending be strong the way it has been and the players playing defense the way they have, then they can allow them to turn it up. I'm not saying that there's some, you know, game 15 Coach Maurice is like, all right, I like the defensive structure. Now let's start using our offense. But I'm saying that, to me, from an outside observer, appears to be what he's trying to do. He's not trying to stifle all these guys. He's just saying, let's play better defensively. Because that's, I mean, again, what was everybody's big complaint last year? Was that this team didn't have any defensive structure.
Yeah, but I think it's, you know, at the expense of offense right now. And when you have four guys that were in the top 20 in scoring last year, right? Mark Scheifele, Blake Wheeler, Nikolai Ehlers, and Patrick Laine. I mean, these players have not opened up offensively.
Not at all.
So
but
far.
Again,
I mean, Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler had no points on this last little two-game road trip. Right.
It's a difficult question to answer, Dave, because I understand what you're saying is that you need the defensive structure first, because if you just went offense, you know, like we've seen in the last couple of years, then there's no defensive structure at all. It seems like they can't do both.
But I would suggest it's just not something that you can just decide, okay, well, we're going to be a better defensive team because we've got good players, and we're going to just suddenly continue our offense. So I simply think change that, again, from the coaching staff perspective, based on what I've seen. They're trying to change the culture initially this season. Because remember, you know, they're playing these games together. That's where you're going to get it. Get that structure in place, and then you can allow, once you have that, once you feel confident that your team has that structure, then you can allow the horses, you can give them their head and allow them to go. So I think, to me, it seems by design, not by mistake. I think that's what the coaching staff is trying to implement. That's just my observation.
The problem will come up if the defensive structure continues, but the opposition is able to get more goals. Then all of a sudden, what's the point of the defensive structure? Because you're not scoring and you're not defending. Yeah. So then you're just a bad team at that point in time. It'll be something very interesting to continue to watch throughout the course of the next 10, 12 games, the next stretch of games. When we come back, Tim Campbell of NHL.com joins us for some more Winnipeg Jets talk. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. The bottom of the hour has come and gone. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mundell, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us in studio via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website, it's got the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio. That's IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Tim Campbell. Tim covers the NHL for NHL.com. Tim, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing very well, Tim. How about yourself?
Excellent today.
Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us on this Saturday morning. Tim, we were just talking about the Jets and sort of the philosophy that the team seems to be employing thus far this year, in that it's defense and defense structure first, and that their offensive players, I mean, because they have a top six that's, you know, pretty well regarded throughout the NHL, that their offensive players seem as though they're having the reins pulled in on them, and they're not being able to use their skill and their speed as much as we've seen in the last few years. Your observations maybe on that topic, first and foremost, about the Jets' structure and their philosophy this season.
Well, I'm not so sure that they've had their reins pulled in. No one's told me this directly, but what I sense is the Jets collectively have recognized that they have to do better and do more to cut down on scoring chances against. And, the stats and the fact that the season has ended in early April, the last two springs, have driven that point home. I don't think Paul Maurice or anyone else in the Jets organization has to sit at the arena and rant and rave at the players about a better defense. I think they've all experienced two early ends to their season, some terrible numbers defensively. And it seems to me that the team has decided that they better pay attention to this. So, in order to do this, and especially to get comfortable at this new sort of mindset, I think they've tried to be more responsible. And I looked at some stats yesterday, and I wasn't even looking for this. I was looking for something else yesterday, but I came upon some stats yesterday that some advanced stats that had the Jets at number 31 in the league in terms of scoring chances created so far. Now, that's a bit of a subjective stats list, but whether it's 31 or 25 or even 21 in that lower range, that tells you, what you suggested in your question, that scoring chances are down. But how it's happening, I maybe would subscribe to the theory that the players themselves, they've understood the message from the coach that we're going to have to be more diligent, responsible, and I'm not sure their reins have been pulled in. They probably pulled them in themselves in order to try to do a better job at this.
Tim, you're in Edmonton now, but you've covered the Jets for many years, going back to the Jets 1.0. When you watch a game like last night and the Jets' inability to get anything going on the power play, are you surprised that with all the talent and skill that this team has, that the power play continues to struggle?
Yeah, I am surprised. I did watch the game yesterday, and I was kind of surprised at how unsettled and sort of uncertain the two offensive teams, the Power Play 1 and Power Play 2, were in that game. And it seemed to be universal to my eyes from the first period when they had all those chances, right through to the third period when they had another chance. And you have to give Columbus some credit. They're a pretty good penalty-killing team in the overall numbers. So that tells you they're aggressive and they have good anticipation and all those things that good penalty-killing teams have. So, there's two teams on the ice, and what Columbus was doing clearly was well prepared for what the Jets were going to try to do. But I'm with you. I regard their personnel in that power play as pretty dangerous, and it should produce some results. So when it looks that off as it did yesterday, I would think that's going to be an area that needs some work, given that there's likely to be a practice today and ahead this week with some home games coming up. I would think the focus now will go over there to try to get some more crispness, some confidence. I'm not sure, you know, I'm not a coach. I don't know how coaches try to get a power play better, but you certainly can work on your execution. That's always a good place to start.
Tim, are you surprised that the Jets have been carrying eight defensemen all season long? And do you think that Tucker Pullman would probably benefit from playing down with the Manitoba Moose, big minutes with the Moose?
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, the debate was raging, I think. Well, it probably raged through the summer, but even from the rookie camp and then when training camp, I think by the time training camp was underway, I mean, some of the guys I've talked to around Winnipeg and other media folks who watch the team very regularly and diligently, you know, this was a really interesting discussion. Once it became apparent that Tucker Pullman was not just some other rookie draft pick that was, you know, had joined the team and turned pro, you know, he is a little older, and, you know, I've always held the view he's going to be a player. You know, some folks seem to think he's a bit from left field, that it's unexpected, but I mean, he's just a guy who's mobile and pretty smart. And he's got that knack to get shots and pucks through defenders in the offensive zone. He knows how to do the simple play, and it sounds dumb, but it's something that young players and new players and rookies don't figure out quickly sometimes in the NHL. But he's got all those things, and once that became apparent in camp, it always became for me, you know, I can hardly wait to see what they'll do with this situation, because he's bona fide. He deserves some ice time. I mean, he hasn't embarrassed himself when he's played. They've actually asked him to play the offside, which to me, you know, even though he might have struggled in that one game when he did that, I mean, that's pretty high praise from an experienced NHL coach, you know, who's coached all these games, to recognize that a young player could actually maybe do that and help them out for a game. It's maybe not ideal. So, you know, he's the focal point of why they have eight. And, you know, the second part to your question is, would he be better off playing for a time for the Moose? To me, the answer is definitively yes on that. I don't see how any minutes in a pro game would hurt him. You know, whether they want him to observe, they probably think he's smart enough that when he sits in the press box and watches the game, he's not just worried about how much butter is on his popcorn. you know, he's watching to see not only what, you know, Buff and Toby Enstrom and Tyler Myers do while they're out there, but all their opponents. And, you know, they've seen some pretty good ones so far, people like Ryan Suter and the like. So I just think they realize he's probably a pretty big sponge. Will he go to the Moose? I don't know, but if it was for 2 weeks sometime down the road here soon, it certainly, in my view, wouldn't hurt him. And he could come back quite easily and help out when needed. And I have a feeling he's going to be needed. I always go back to this phrase, and it certainly isn't mine. It comes to me from Craig Heisinger many, many, many years ago about how your roster is shaped during a year, that you can't get anywhere in a season without at least 10 defensemen in your organization. So I think that applies strongly here, and Tucker's going to be a big part of that.
Tim Campbell's our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Tim is with NHL.com. Tim, you split your time between Manitoba and Alberta, so you're very familiar with the two teams in Alberta. The Edmonton Oilers were a popular Stanley Cup pick at the beginning of the year, certainly off to some struggles this year. 3-5-1, 7 points in 9 games, 20 goals for only in those 9 games, which is hard to believe with a guy named Connor McDavid on the team. Is the 20 goals for just show how significantly the Oilers missed Leon Draisaitl when he was out of the lineup?
Well, that's part of it. You know, there's been much hand-wringing, as you might expect so far here in Edmonton. I'm in Edmonton this week about what's the matter with the Oilers. I mean, the other night against Dallas, 5 goals at 5-on-5, in fact, was a pretty big breakout for Edmonton, given, you know, how low their shooting percentage had been. And it was I think it was 3.5% in their previous seven games. At 5-on-5, they were shooting some horrible percentage. So they got some bounces the other night, a couple goals and went in off skates and, you know, created some better chances. And the game was only close because Dallas has an unbelievably good power play. So it's surprising given how good McDavid is. Draisaitl certainly is a pretty important, I wouldn't even call him supporting cast. He's kind of like star number 1A. He's a really strong two-way player and really creative and faster than you think. And I can't say that I'm totally surprised the Oilers have struggled, but given the massive expectations, and not just the expectations, but how fast the expectations have climbed here in the last, let's say, 6 months, it's not unsurprising that the Oilers are discovering that other teams are ready to play too. So, I mean, what they play in Washington tonight at Rogers Place, and you know, another team that's not off to a great start. I don't know what will happen tonight. It's been highly unpredictable, I think, the whole first month of the season. So, you know, Edmonton's got their issues. They're working hard on some of them, but I think a lot of people and their expectations might have gotten a bit carried away here about how easily the Oilers were going to, you know, win the division or win the conference or get to the Stanley Cup final. I mean, those, I've heard a lot of those picks in the last while, and it's just not as easy as having a high opinion of your team or yourself.
Tim, how much does that Oilers defense miss Andre Sequeira?
Yeah, they miss him quite a lot. I read an interesting piece maybe a month ago about, I guess it was kind of prescient that, you know, the longer this goes on the season, the more value Sekera is going to have to the Oilers. To me, it was kind of comical because they know how good he is. I mean, he's just a sort of a non-flashy, experienced player who knows how to pass the puck. And he's pretty smart, and he's kind of a low-key guy. I remember telling this to a few of my colleagues here last year, and even in Winnipeg. You know, I began last year for NHL.com, just kind of splitting my time between Edmonton and Winnipeg. But one of my observations of the Oilers, things I didn't know that I was learning last year, was that Andre Sekera was a way better player than I thought he was for all the years that, you know, I was covering hockey just in Winnipeg, of course, on the road sometimes and watching teams around the league. But with a little more of a daily look and a close-up view, you know, he was one of the reasons I thought that the Oilers were better than people thought was, you know, him and Chris Russell and Oscar Klefbom and Adam Larson, who I have a really high regard for. Those four guys, to me, last season were a huge, huge reason in Edmonton why the Oilers made such a leap forward. I think 33 points up in the standings. Yeah, that and combined with the fact that they had a real goalie and a real good goalie, Cam Talbot. I mean, the Oilers, for their 10 miserable years out of the playoffs, when they weren't even just out of the playoffs, they were sad, they transformed fairly quickly into a team that stopped spending so much time in their own end. And that time then went to the neutral zone and the offensive zone. And that, to me, was probably the biggest explanation for why they went so far up in the standings last year and into this contenders role. They actually had a functioning defense and took all that fire drill time on the back end and put it to good use.
Tim, heading a little bit farther south from you, in Calgary, Jaromír Jágr is injured right now. I think he's close to returning. What kind of impact do you think he could have on this roster?
I think he's going to have a considerable impact on the roster. I was frankly surprised that Glenn Gullison had him for a spell on the first line there. I mean, in his second game, I thought that might happen in a month once Jágr was sort of acclimatized and, you know, it's always hard to go to a new team, but of course he's got lots of experience in that area, so he's pretty good at figuring things out. He's got a pretty impressive hockey brain. The fact that they had him with Sean Monahan and Johnny Gaudreau in his second game of the year, I was almost stunned by that. It didn't last the whole game, but that shows you the faith they have in him and how real they think his ability still is. And it is real. I think the game before he got hurt, I was watching that game and watching him control the puck and make plays and, you know, just play the game the way they want it played. He was an impact player just before he got hurt. So a small setback here. But I think he's already shown there in some glimpses and flashes that this isn't just an experiment in Calgary, that they're not dipping their toe in the water here to see if he can help them. They were pretty sure he could, and I think what he showed in the games he's played already is that he will help them. I know there's a lot of angst in Calgary right now about the numbers and how Mark Jankowski, who's kind of their up-and-coming, promising young center, they've got high hopes for. They think quite a lot of him. He had a good training camp, probably earned his spot, but the numbers game has kind of gotten him, maybe as it's gotten Tucker Poolman in Winnipeg. And one of the reasons that the numbers game has got Jankowski in Calgary is because Jágr is there. And so you'd scratch your head and wonder what a team is doing, you know, putting its eggs in a 45-year-old basket when they've got a pretty impressive 21 or 22-year-old basket, you know, ready to help them long-term. But, you know, so all these things to me point to the fact that Jágr is going to help them, assuming, of course, he stays healthy. And they did their homework in Calgary on this signing. I don't really think it was a lark or a shot in the dark. The Flames have had some issues in other areas. You know, certainly at home they've been kind of poor so far. They got beat by Dallas's power play last night. They haven't been all that great at home. But I think Calgary will get this sort of thing figured out. They, as a team, you know, especially with Jágr, they've got a good enough defense and a good enough goalie that I think Calgary is yet to be or is going to be a force to be reckoned with in the West.
Tim, one last question for you here. Kyler Yamamoto, is it safe to say that he's going to stick up with the Oilers?
No, I don't think. I wouldn't be in the camp that says it's that safe yet. I don't have my stats right in front of me. Was he played six games so far?
Seven games, yeah.
7 games so far. You know, there's that magic 10-game number. I think the Oilers are treading kind of cautiously here now. They sat him out against Dallas the other night, and I'm really not convinced he'll go in tonight against Washington, given that Edmonton played much better on Thursday. And I think Todd McLellan's one of those guys. He'll be really reluctant to change his lineup after winning. Started to see some good signs from his group the other night. So, you know, he's asked about Yamamoto now almost on a daily basis here. And yesterday he was still singing Kyler's praises. They like what he's done. They think his confidence has increased. His touches have been more impactful. He makes plays. He's created some chances. They've had him with McDavid for spells. They see a pretty dynamic little player, and he is a little player. But I have yet to see the outward sign. I mean, they talk glowingly about him, but I've yet to see the outward sign that he's staying. They're clearly biding their time here. They may put him in another game or two. They might go right to the 9-game number, and then they'll have a hard call to make. And I mean, unless they get some crazy rash of injuries here or some really bad luck in the next couple of weeks, I'd have to be leaning to the fact that he'll, you know, he may go back to junior sooner as opposed to later. It doesn't mean he will, but you can see them starting to tread cautiously here on the matter. They've really been impressed with what he's done. He's got a great sort of incentive carrot in front of him here. He's had a great taste of the NHL, which should only help his, you know, his closing junior days here, if in fact he goes back to junior. So I think it's all signs look good here for Yamamoto, but I'm not sure he stays too much longer.
Well, if he is sent back, I'm sure Spokane will be happy about that.
No doubt.
Yeah, there'll be a party there somewhere, actually. Yeah.
Tim Campbell covers the NHL for NHL.com. Tim, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
I'm sure we'll talk again soon, guys. Have a great day.
Undoubtedly we will. Thanks again, Tim. When we come back, we look ahead to the Jets' month of November. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Shortly before the hour of 10, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thanks to Tim Campbell of NHL.com for joining us. This segment of the show brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. The month of October isn't quite over yet. Still two games to go, tomorrow against Pittsburgh and Tuesday in Minnesota. But that's not too soon to look forward to the month of November. Jets have 14 games in November. Certainly a bit of a busier month than October was, as it usually is in the NHL. Five divisional games, so we got our first real big chunk of divisional games for the first time this year. As we know, it's mostly been either Eastern Conference teams or Pacific Conference teams so far in October. Three games against the two worst teams in the NHL as it currently stands, the Arizona Coyotes and the Montreal Canadiens, and five games against 2016-17 playoff teams. So I think, gents, it's safe to say the month of October isn't quite as difficult. The month of November isn't quite as difficult as the month of October was, but it's still going to be, you know, for a Jets team that's still trying to find its legs, they have no room for error and, you know, can't have any significant losing streaks, which they've been done well to avoid so far this year, with the exception of the two-gamer to start the season.
Well, as you guys both know, the Thanksgiving weekend is the one that everybody talks about in
U.S. Thanksgiving. Yeah.
I was going to just qualify by saying the U.S. Thanksgiving, that is. To wanting to be in a playoff spot. I mean, of course, you have to make hay, you know, with the opportunities that you get early in the season, and you can't afford to have lulls. And again, we're not talking, the Jets aren't a top five team that are letting go against, you know, weaker competition. The Jets right now have to prove, if you want to be a playoff team, you have to prove it, and you have to beat everyone, whether it's a good team or it's a bad team. And that sounds obvious, but I mean, it's true. You can't have these letdown games. You can't play, oh, we played down to our competition because, you know, the Arizona Coyotes haven't won a game yet. You have to beat the Arizona Coyotes. You have to beat the Dallas Stars because they're, you know, division games that you can't afford to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's it's imperative. And, you know, look, let's look at the Jets schedule. There's lots of opportunities here. It's not like it's a crazy back-to-back-to-back-to-back schedule. They have, from what I can see, two back-to-backs in November.
Yeah.
And they're not hard. Anaheim and San Jose, that's easy. And Vegas and
you're
and
saying it travel's easy.
From a travel perspective, those are easy. You know, it's not like they're,
I wouldn't say they're easy games when you're
talking about
Anaheim and San Jose.
Definitely not. But obviously, I'm saying from a travel perspective, you're not flying from, you know, across the country to get your next game. So I'm simply saying, from a scheduling perspective, this is not a difficult November, and this is an opportunity for a Jets team to put points in the standings bank that they can rely on later in the season.
Especially when you compare it to last year, when they had 16 games in the month of November, and that had a lot to do with the compression with the World Cup and all of that. But when you're talking about these 14 games, Drew, 7 of the 14 games are against teams that didn't make the playoffs last year. And you mentioned earlier, the Jets have two games against the Coyotes, a team that hasn't won yet this year. And, you know, there are going to be challenging games on the schedule. I mean, you've got divisional games, two against Dallas, one against Nashville. Obviously, Colorado is improved, but that's a team that you should beat. So it's not the hardest schedule. It's spaced out pretty nicely. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, they've played Columbus twice, Pittsburgh twice, they're going to play Minnesota twice in October, you know, the month of November certainly looks a lot easier. But again, I mean, are there really ever easy games in the NHL?
No, there certainly aren't. So you have to show up each and every night. Otherwise, if you don't, if you take your competition too lightly, you end up losing games you shouldn't.
So it looks nice on the calendar, but, you know, we'll see what they do.
When we come back, Anson Carter of NHL on NBC joins us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mindell, Dave Minuke, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve.
facebook.com/illegalcurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the MSG Network and NBC Sports, Anson Carter joins us on the program. Anson, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Always appreciate your time, Anson. You know, we spent a lot of time in the first hour of the show, and we're going to continue in the second hour, Anson, talking about the Winnipeg Jets power play and the struggles of the Winnipeg Jets power play. Now, I'm not going to ask you specifically about the Jets, but in your experience in the NHL and your years playing hockey, you know, when a power play is struggling and it doesn't have any confidence and it's losing the puck battles, how do you turn things around? Like, what needs to be the catalyst to getting a struggling power play back into looking like a quality power play?
Well, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to have a difficult power play because every team is watching video constantly. And you have a lot of players that are specialized just to play on the penalty kill. So they might not be playing as many minutes in the PP or even 5-on-5 as they are on the penalty kill situation. So you've got that to deal with, but if your power play is struggling, the easiest thing you could do is just simplify the game. Now, first, you've got to focus on your entries. If you can't get in the offensive zone, you're not going to be able to set up. So you have to get into the offensive zone, whether it's puck retrieval, putting the puck where you want to get it and getting it back quickly, and moving the puck around. But you can't overthink those situations. You know, when things are going well for you in the power play, you could make tic-tac plays. You could pass it through guys' skates. You could pass it under guys' sticks, little sauce through traffic, and it all works for you. But when things aren't going well, other teams' bodies end up getting in the way. The passes are off. The puck's wobbling. The puck's bouncing. It's not the player's wheelhouse for one-timers, and everything's going against you. So what I would always do in the power play is just simplify things. Make a couple good passes, get a point shot, make sure I get screens in front. Now you want to try to get a double screen in front so you can have the high tip or the low tip, and you want to have traffic going to the net. And then once you get that one goal and the guys start feeling better about themselves, then you can start making things a little more complicated and go into your sets that you have normally when you're playing with a lot of confidence. But you can't do that unless you simplify things early, get shots on net, and get little things you could build on mentally to go forward with.
Anson, in your opinion, why have the New York Rangers struggled so much? They've played 11 games now. They only have 3 wins, and they've had 9 of their first 11 games at home.
You know, it's pretty easy. They just haven't scored goals. The New York Rangers' defensive core hasn't been as good in their own zone. And when I say defensive core, I just don't mean this, the two men in the back end. I mean all 5 guys playing on the ice as they have been in previous years. Like, that's a team that's predicated on their team defense the last 4 or 5 years. And their team defense hasn't been as strong. Dan Girardi was sent to Tampa Bay. Even Anton Stralman a couple years ago went to Tampa Bay. Tony DeAngelo wasn't ready. Kevin Shattenkirk, who's a great offensive player, isn't as strong as a Dan Girardi in his defensive zone. And Henrik Lundqvist isn't a spring chicken anymore. You know, Hank is 25, and they really relied on Hank to win a lot of hockey games for them the last 10 years. And he's not the same goaltender right now. So you have to turn things around, help him out, have your forwards help out, and they just haven't been as good. They've got Mika Zibanejad playing there. They've got Kevin Hayes up front. Like, down the middle, they aren't as strong as they have been in previous years either. So centerman position is so important to your D-zone coverage. And they just it's been a combination of all those factors. And then playing at home, I played in New York for the Rangers, and it's tough when you're losing. When you're winning, it's one of the best places in the world because every team brings their A game to play at MSG. There's some arenas, there's Canadian rinks, and there's some American arenas that doesn't matter what you're doing, how you're feeling, you could be battling flu, you could be sick, you could be tired, whatever. But when you step foot in those arenas, you want to make sure you bring your A game more so than some other rinks. And MSG is one of those arenas where you'll never see a team's B game. Players love playing there, so if you get off to the wrong start, it snowballs pretty quickly for you with the New York Rangers.
Well, Anson, talking about arenas that opposing teams may not like playing in, it looks like Vegas is never going to lose in their home rink. You know, it might be one of the most unexpected stories in hockey right now is the fact that they're 8-1 to start this season, playing third in the Western Conference. What do you see? Is this an effect of a new team? Are they gelling? Or is this something about the new city and players having to go to this new city that's changing the dynamic in hockey's newest market?
Well, I think it's the perfect storm.
to be honest with you. I think it's Las Vegas, an expansion city. There's a couple expansion cities from previous years where I would talk to guys that being exposed to the expansion draft, and they're hoping and praying they weren't drafted by that team. This summer I talked to a lot of guys, and they're hoping and praying they were drafted by Vegas. So, you know, guys love playing there. They enjoy the city. They're totally embracing a new opportunity, and they have a really good team. I mean, George McPhee did his homework. He definitely put in his work. And if you're going to pay $500 million for an expansion team like Bill Foley did, you better have a damn good team. Like, you're not getting the scrubs. You've got a first-line player in James Neal. You've got a number one goaltender in Marc-Andre Fleury. You've got good top young prospects like Alec Tuck. And you've got a lot of good young players that can mix in that whole match. So when you put that all together, and then you have Vegas, and, you know, a lot of teams could be going in there early, might be enjoying Vegas too much. Who knows? I'm not really sure. But it's a perfect storm for them to get off to a good start. It's a good story for the league.
Anson Carter is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Anson covers the NHL for MSG and NBC on NHL. Anson, you represented Canada internationally a few different times, World Championships, World Junior Championships. For the guys who are playing overseas now, the guys whose NHL careers have, you know, pretty clearly ended or are maybe just getting started, in the case of some of the really younger guys, the 19-year-olds, what's going through their mind, you figure, as we're getting closer and closer to Olympic time, where the team is going to be named that's going to represent Canada in South Korea at the Olympics? If you're one of those fringe guys, those bubble guys playing in Europe, what's going through your mind about the potential to represent Canada at the Olympics?
Well, you want to make sure, first of all, it starts in the summertime. You know, those guys that are playing over there, you know, they got a great opportunity. I think sometimes you play over in Europe, you're a forgotten man, and you think nobody's really watching or paying attention to you, but this year that isn't the case. So you want to make sure in the summertime your training is up to par. And those leagues start earlier than North American leagues. They just get going in August. So you want to make sure you got a solid base of summer training under your feet, but you want to get off to a good start. The starts could be so crucial regardless of what you did in the past, because a lot of times Hockey Canada picks the best players that are going right now for just a short tournament like that, where guys have to gel and come together rather quickly. But it's a tremendous experience and opportunity for those guys. You know, a lot of guys that are playing over there might see the door to playing the National Hockey League closed, or they might not have thought they'd ever get the opportunity to play the National Hockey League. But this is something that could, you know, really elevate their profile if they get a chance to play for their country. And it's like no other experience in the world. You know, I played the National Hockey League for so many different years, but playing over the World Championships or playing in an international event, World Juniors, is like nothing that I can compare it to, because you see guys elevating their games to a whole different level. And I'll give you a perfect example. Michael Nylander played for a long time in the National Hockey League. He was a good player, but when he went over there and played for Team Sweden, I played against him, he was like Wayne Gretzky. He was the best player that I've ever seen in international ice. And Matt Sundin came back over there. Peter Forsberg came over there, but it wasn't even close to being, you know, Nylander. And I attribute that to putting on that Swedish jersey, and he took his game to a whole different level. I mean, one year they smoked, I think, 9-1 or 10-1, I think. And I was like, wow, like, who's this Nylander guy? Like, where do you come from? So that's just another example, or a perfect example, of when players put on that jersey, they're playing for pride. You're not getting paid. No one's paying any extra dollars to be there. You're doing it just for the pride and the joy of playing for your country. And it's a wonderful experience, especially if you get a chance to win. Winning makes it that much more special.
You know, Anson, listening to you talk about representing Team Canada at the international level, it makes me want to bring up the highlights of you scoring that golden goal from the 2003 World Championships, arguably one of the best goals in Team Canada history.
Oh, I love it. I can never stop talking about that goal. So even though I live here in Atlanta, my friends always bring it up when it comes on TV, and, you know, top 10 goals they see back home, they'll DVR'd or send a quick video with their phone and send it to me. We'll have a good chuckle over it. But the thing that amazed me when I think about that goal is how they never thought it was a goal to begin with. I mean, I knew right from the get-go that it was a goal. You know, I took the puck and went flying down the wing. I was able to get the rebound off the goalie's pads and do the quick wraparound. And I saw the space between the goal line and the white in the back of the net, like, very clearly. So I was just thankful they had the proper technology. They were able to blow up that little piece of the ice so they could see that same separation that I saw. But even though it was a bang-bang play, it was pretty clear to me that it was a goal. And, you know, I always tell people I'm pretty lucky, and I'm very lucky that it did go in,
because during that crazy chaotic celebration, I ended up tweaking my knee. So we tried to keep playing. There's no way I could continue. I was all done.
Well, I know, Anson, that 30 million plus Canadians were pretty happy when that puck crossed the goal line. Just sticking with the 2018 Winter Olympics, you know, there have been, you know, talks of junior-aged players potentially representing Canada at the 2018 Winter Olympics. Jordan Kyrou, St. Louis Blues draft pick, is one player who's been mentioned that Team Canada might want to bring because of the relationship between Marty Brodeur, of course, assistant GM with the Blues. In your opinion, do you think that junior-age players should be allowed to go play in the Olympics in South Korea?
Yeah, if they're ready to play, I don't see why not. I think back to when I was younger and the Big E, Eric Lindros, played for Team Canada in the Canada Cup.
Sure.
And he was underage, and the Big E was clearly ready. I remember he ran Samuelson. It was great. It was awesome. He proved that he was ready to play. Like, I don't think you should curry favors to anyone and just say, well, this manager like Marty Brodeur has a relationship with this guy. He's on Team Canada's front office. So therefore, we should allow one of his players to come and play. I think it just depends on if the kid is able to play and if he's, you know, accept that responsibility and he's earned it based on his own merits. But if the kid's able to play, why not? I don't think that should be a problem. It should be the best players that Canada has to offer to get the opportunity to play over there. So I don't think age should be an restriction whatsoever.
Anson, you're living in Atlanta now, but you were born and raised in Toronto, I believe. And, you know, you're a Toronto guy, and, you know, you see the Maple Leafs are finally having success. What do you think it's like right now in that market for the fan base and for the players, the pressure to succeed? Because, you know, it seems like the brass is trying to temper expectations, but clearly this is a good young team that could make some noise in the playoffs this season.
Oh, it's nuts. I was just home for Thanksgiving, just a few weeks ago. That's one of our annual trips back home to go back to Thanksgiving. We celebrate my family, my brother's family, my sister's family, and, you know, extended friends. And it's the best way to describe it. It's a gong show there. Like, everyone's ordering the Stanley Cup rings. They're planning the parade there. And I know Lou Lamoriello and Shane are trying their best to really calm things down, but this is a real deal for them, thinking they've got to finally have an opportunity to break that Stanley Cup curse. I love watching their team. Their team's awesome to watch. You know, Austin Matthews, I've known about him for several years before he played the National Hockey League, because my agent, Pat Brisson, has been keeping me abreast of different young players he has, you know, in his pipeline coming. And he'd always tell me, like, Ace, this guy's special. He's special. And he would know. I mean, Breeze represents Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane and Sidney Crosby and John Tavares, and, like, you name it, Kopitar. So he would know. And when he came up, when I saw him play in the World Championships for Team USA, it gives me an opportunity to watch a lot of different young players play in that tournament before they step foot in the National Hockey League. And I was able to watch Patrick Laine. I was able to watch Jack Eichel, players of that nature. And Austin Matthews was awesome. So I knew right away he was going to be special. And I think he's the key to that hockey club. With Willie Nylander, those two have a special chemistry together. And with Kadri there playing in that third or second line, whatever you want to call him, he's really the glue of that team, because he makes it hard against other teams' top players. So they've got a chance to have a really deep, long run there in Toronto. And I know the fans are definitely pumped and anticipating a special run in the spring.
Anson, we'll let you go on this last question. As good as things are going in Toronto, they're going just that poorly in Montreal. Obviously, a horrendous start to the season for the Habs. Alex Galchenyuk, he's been at the center of all the attention for the Habs' struggles so far. This week, it gets even worse there. You know, there's accusations regarding, off-ice issues with Alex that really have no place in the public domain. You know, if you were a player, is there a worse market to struggle in, to be struggling in, than Montreal?
No, there isn't. I mean, any Canadian market, and I would always chuckle to myself, because I'd always hear about Canada and the Canadian markets and being great. And I played in Vancouver. I played in Edmonton. I love playing there. I had some good years in all those Canadian cities, and I enjoyed the scrutiny and the spotlight. A lot of guys aren't built for that. And a lot of these Canadian players who, you know, I hear Canadian fans, my friends would say, oh, this guy's great. He's a Canadian hero. A lot of guys don't want to play in Canada. I know for a fact a lot of Canadian players, that even guys in the Hall of Fame, that vetoed a lot of deals, saying they didn't want to have that pressure and that scrutiny of playing in Canada. So as much as the fans, you know, love the Canadian teams, and they love, you know, watch what guys are eating for breakfast and how guys are taping their sticks and, you know, all that kind of stuff, a lot of guys don't want to play in Canada, you know, for those very reasons. Because when things are going poorly, It's not easy. And if you don't embrace that pressure, if you don't embrace the fact that people, you know, are living and dying with everything you do on the ice and off the ice, it's going to eat you up. And Montreal is probably the worst for it because those fans are super passionate. And Galchenyuk, I think he just needs to get traded. You know, I think he needs a fresh start, get him a new scenery, get out of there, get his career back on track again. I like him as a hockey player, but he's stalling there. And that team in Montreal, I think they're built for 5 years ago, too. With the way the game is being played right now, I think they're totally built wrong. And you know, I hear the Patrick Waugh cheers for Carey Price and that. And you don't want to turn on Carey Price. Like, that guy's a franchise right there. And you don't want him going the other way for your hockey club. So I hope for Claude Julien, who I think is a pretty good coach, I hope things turn around for them quickly. But I'm not quite sure what that team is doing in terms of their personnel. I think they got to change things up a little bit.
Anson Carter is with the MSG Network and NHL on NBC. Anson, appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, guys. Anytime.
Well, appreciate it, Anson. Thanks again. Let's head to break. When we come back, we talk about the Jets' power play struggles, and we look at the penalty kill as well. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday on TSN 1290.
Cross crease. He can throw it through a seam or back to the point. He's got so many off. Matthew Burrell start the season there. And for Lyon, he scores! Patrick Laine, the cross-ice pass was in a little tight, but snipers find a way to get it on net, and Laine's third of the year has the Jets in front. Delay there by Scheifele. Now he finds some room against Zucker. Scheifele spins it back to Laine, tees it, and scores! Patrick Laine rips it up to the top part of the net. His second of the game.
That's half the Winnipeg Jets' power play goals on the season. Those two coming last Friday night off the stick of Patrick Laine. That was in the Jets' Wild game last Friday night, the game the Jets won. Power play struggles galore for the Winnipeg Jets. They were on display last night as they went 0-6 on the power play against the Columbus Blue Jackets. The power play now ranked 27th in the NHL, operating at a 12.9%. You know, this is not a new struggle for the Winnipeg Jets under Paul Maurice. The power play has been pretty dismal now for the last few years. I mean, last year it finished, I believe, at the same. It finished 18th in the NHL, so it was a little bit better than it is currently right at this point in time. But you know, with the talent the Jets have, and nobody can dispute that the Jets' talent is there, why the power play struggles so much? As why do they consistently not find a way to even look competent on the power play? It's one thing if you control the puck and you move it around and you have some shots and you have some good zone time. Most people are okay with that. It's the fact they just don't even look competent on the power play that bothers people so much.
Well, I wouldn't say that the Jets don't look competent on the power play. I mean,
last night?
Well, I mean, if you want to take one game, Drew, when you're talking about the power play, sure, right now it's bottom five in the NHL. And it's really surprising, guys, because in the preseason, it seemed like every time the Jets had a power play, they scored. How many power play goals did the Jets have in the preseason, Dave? 11, I think? 12?
Oh, yeah, something like that.
It was something like 11.
12 of their 15 preseason goals were on the power play?
Right, and you could say whatever you want about preseason hockey, but I mean, that's preparing for the regular season. So when you're talking about, you know, the Jets' struggles on the power play, I mean, guys, I wish I had all the answers. I mean, I think if the Jets coaching staff...
You have a book right beside you that says all the answers.
But when you're talking about, you know, this power play, I agree, Drew. When you're talking about Patrick Laine, you're talking about arguably the best shot in the NHL. When you're talking about Mark Scheifele, you're talking about Blake Wheeler, Nikolai Ehlers, Dustin Byfuglien, Jacob Trouba. I mean, the personnel is there for the Jets. Right now, to me, especially last game, one of the biggest issues with the Jets is it's not a quick enough power play. Their zone entries have not been good. Their puck retrievals have not been very good. And the sustained pressure that they have in the other team's zone has not been good enough. So when the Jets do set up, I mean, we know that there are a lot of weapons. We know that many players have the ability to shoot the puck. Patrick Laine, Nikolai Ehlers, Jacob Trouba's got a great shot. We know that Buff is usually manning the point. He's got a great shot. And we know that they can get traffic in front of the opposing team's goaltender, whether that's Adam Lowry when he's healthy. Brendan Lemieux was out there on the power play. I believe he got 2 minutes of power play time yesterday for the Jets. So, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, what's wrong, I don't think it's just one thing, Drew. I mean, you know, I named a few I mean, anyone could tell you watching that game yesterday what was wrong. I mean, there wasn't urgency. The zone entries were not good. And there was no sustained pressure. But when the Jets' power play is clicking, I mean, you could say that they have all of those three things, right? So, I mean, I don't know if it's one or two things. It's probably five or six things. But right now, I would say that right now the power play is not giving them the boost in games. In fact, it's almost like they're putting too much pressure on themselves to get that perfect pass or set up that perfect play. They're not even getting into that position to allow themselves to really have a good power play because it's almost too rushed at times. That's what I would say. I mean, you saw it at one point, Kyle Connor got the puck, and it's almost like he was a hot potato, and he just got rid of it right away. So I think right now, you know, Anson Carter just talked about it. I think you want to maybe simplify things and get back to what you were doing earlier in the season. And we've seen the Jets succeed on the power play against Minnesota. So, I mean, it's one of those questions that's hard to answer. Well, why aren't the Jets succeeding? Well, why did they succeed against Minnesota, Drew?
It's a fair question that you make. Dave, at this point in time, under Paul Maurice as the Jets head coach, at least the full seasons, so taking away the year he came, you know, partway through, the Jets are 27th in the power play over the last 3 years in the entire NHL. So should we expect anything different? The personnel is similar. I mean, obviously Nikolaj Ehlers and Patrick Laine have joined the power play on a regular basis in the last couple of years. The personnel is similar. The coach is the same. The coaching staff is the same. So should we really at this point in time just say this is the power play, this is the skills, this is the level the power play is going to operate at? Is there any reason to think that it's going to be better given the coaching staff is still the same?
Well, I mean, I guess, no, that's a fair point, because how are you going to change something if the personnel, if everything's the same? If everything's the same and you're continuing to do all the same things, then you're obviously not going to see many different results. Now, the truth is, how did they have success in the preseason? Now, did they only have it when it was a mix of the Jets playing their NHL guys against, you know, more AHL guys, and perhaps that's the reason why the numbers were skewed? I think as he hit on it, really for me, it's speed. It's just the urgency. It's they're very laissez-faire with the puck in the zone. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you guys, there's no power play. Like, it's supposed to be a man advantage, and the Jets don't look like they have a 5-on-4 advantage a lot of times. A lot of times, the teams are attacking the Jets, and it's because I think they know that the Jets are taking too long with the puck. So I think, you know, in some instances, as you're right, like Kyle Connor, you know, a little hot potato sometimes, but like other times, it's not so much just, it's the way in which they're getting rid of the puck, and the passing is just not crisp. And to me, that's the key, because if a pass is, if a guy has to stop and get a reach behind him to get a pass, as opposed to having the pass right in front of him, that extra second allows the defensive player to get to you, and it doesn't allow you to make the decision. And so the problem is, without this crisp, fast passing, this team just doesn't have an opportunity to take advantage of this power play. So, I mean, to me, you know, when you look at, like, the headlines yesterday in Columbus, it's like, Jackets take advantage of Jets' poor power play. That was one of the, I think it was in the Columbus Dispatch yesterday. That, to me, says it all. I mean, the whole idea of the extra man is to take advantage of it and give your team that energy. And as he talked about in the first segment, it almost had a negative impact on this Jets team. Instead of propelling them forward in the game and giving them, what, they have three power plays to open the game yesterday.
Yes.
They didn't take advantage of that. And as a result of not taking advantage of it, it allows teams that maybe are playing better to stay in the game and not give you that separation you need. So I suspect, you know, you could talk about 5-on-5, but really the power play is something this team needs to take advantage of.
What's so troubling to me, especially last night, and I again, as your point is, Val, that it was only one game last night that they struggled.
And we mentioned this in the first hour. Columbus is a very good defensive team and a good penalty kill
but
as well.
The Jets looked like they just didn't have any answers for what Columbus was throwing at them. Now, the Jets saw Columbus a week ago, so it shouldn't come as a surprise. They do video scouting. It just looks like the Jets were completely befuddled about how do they counteract the Blue Jackets' defensive penalty kill setup.
Yeah, and you'll see teams, you know, load up three forwards at the blue line and kind of force other teams like the Jets.
They're not doing
to
anything
dump the
revolutionary.
No, I mean, all teams to a certain degree have similar systems on the penalty kill. Power play is a little bit different because, you know, you'll oftentimes see the high cycle and you've seen Laine switch sides and you'll see different players in front of the net. But when you're talking about, you know, last night, I mean, the Jets don't have a shortage of players that can carry the puck over the blue line, right? Nikolai Eli Ehlers is one of the best in the NHL at it. You have guys like Blake Wheeler, Mark Scheifele, Brian Little. I mean, the Jets just couldn't get anything going. And it's not just that game. Against Pittsburgh, I mean, I think they had fewer power play opportunities. They didn't have as many as six, that's for sure. I think they had three or four, if I'm not mistaken. But when you're talking about, you know, getting set up, when the Jets get set up, I mean, they're just as dangerous as any other team. We talked about it. I mean, Patrick Laine, is there any other player in the NHL that strikes fear into goaltenders like Patrick Laine, right? So then when you're talking about other players that can hurt you, Mark Scheifele can hurt you, Blake Wheeler can hurt you, Trouba and Byfuglien have blasts from the point. So, I mean, there is no shortage of talented players on this team. But again, this seems to be a weakness for the Jets again this year, which is really perplexing to me.
Last word on this topic, at least for today at least, goes to Jeremy Roenick, outspoken hockey personality. You all know who JR is. This tweet from last night's Jets-Blue Jackets game. The @NHL Jets have had three of the worst power plays I've seen tonight versus the Blue Jackets. How hard is it to set up? Show some urgency. Brutal. JR throwing some smoke at the Winnipeg Jets. When we come back, we talk about the Anaheim Ducks with Hannah Spraker of the fourth period. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.